Hey, this is Ed. So this is a podcast, is that right?
This is.
Okay. We're officially podcasting right now. That's awesome.
This is Straight from the Cutter's Mouth.
Welcome to Straight from the Cutter's Mouth, a retina podcast. At least once a week, we bring you insights and perspectives from the world of vitreoretinal surgery. I'm your host, Dr. Jay Schreeder. Today, on episode 125, we are recapping the September 2018 issue of Retinal Physician. Drs. Ali Khan and Farina Ali join me to discuss this issue, which focuses on diabetic retinopathy issues, including medical retina and surgical retina. Straight from the Cutter's Mouth is now happy to be joined by two retina specialists to discuss the upcoming issue of Retinal Physician for September 2018. First, in alphabetical order by last name, Dr. Farina Ali, recently graduated from Mid-Atlantic Retina at Wills Eye Hospital. Congratulations on being done with fellowship, and now you're entering the club of attendings. Farina Ali, how are you?
I'm doing well. Thanks so much, Jay. Thanks for having me on.
And from University of California, Los Angeles, Doheny Eye Institute, 5'10", 5'11", if you wear sneakers. Dr. Ali Khan, how are you? You're taller than that. I'm just underselling you.
No, actually, I think 5'10" is correct. Good to hear from you, Jake. Glad to be back on.
Perfect. So as similar to other editions of the Retinal Physician kind of coverage, we're not going to spend much time rehashing the articles. You know, if you want to read them, they're up on retinalphysician.com. We're going to use them as jumping off points for discussion. This issue focused on diabetic retinopathy. So the first article, this is a very general article written by David Eichenbaum and Alfred White from the practice in Tampa, Florida, called Decision-Making in Diabetic Retinopathy Treatment, A Variety of Tools Enable Individualized Care. And I'll just summarize too, and then I'll ask you guys some questions. Essentially, they just went through kind of generally, you know, the studies showing that we use a laser for PDR and macular edema studies, the anti-VEGF, steroids, how anti-VEGFs can efface diabetic retinopathy, and then how do you apply all this into treating patients in the clinic with DME or PDR. Let's start with Farina. You know, my question for you is, how do you decide for a patient with DME whether or not you inject them? And then how do you decide which patients you treat with multiple injections over months, which patients you may treat and extend, or which patients you'll treat more on a PRN basis?
Yeah, those are great questions. I mean, I think central involving DME with visual decline will always warrant treatment in my book. I think there are lots of patients who are doing well with good control that don't have center involving DME, but have sort of extra foveal DME that you could watch 20/20, 20/25. But I think if they have center involving DME with symptomatic or objective visual decline on their first visit, I would plan to initiate treatment. There are certain patients who, when they first hear about injection treatments, they want to think about it a little bit, and certainly there's no race against the clock at an early stage like that. But ultimately, when I do start treatment, I would do serial injections once every month for the first 3 months, and then see where things go from there and guide my treatment thereafter. I think early on, I'm less likely to do PRN and more likely to do regular interval treatment. And then, you know, injection type would be guided by their vision in terms of 20/50 or worse, and sort of what is available to them based on their health insurance plan.
Ali, you know, feeding off of that what Farina said, my two spinoff questions are, you know, does, if they have PDR or if they just have NPDR, affect your decision in terms of how you balance injections, and then in case of PDR, whether you do laser? And then the other question is, you know, some of the data from like protocol you showed that, you know, there's a washout period, right? So meaning that they saw that patients who weren't as responsive to the first three injections, but they kept injecting with an additional three, giving them six total, about a third of those patients actually didn't qualify to get a steroid because the edema got better. How does that, and then the Rise Right data talking about, you know, that you may need monthly injections for longer, factor into kind of your approach and then your discussions with the patient when you first meet them?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a couple of things there. Kind of your first point, you know, does it matter if they have PDR or NPDR, you know, along with their DME at outset? And for me, you know, if there is center involving DME, I think Protocol S, and some of our, you know, other studies have shown us that, you know, anti-VEGF does work great for the proliferative sort of aspects of diabetic retinopathy as well. So I think it's actually an easier choice for me. I think if they have center-involving DME and PDR, I will start with injections first, quote-unquote, calm things down and kind of get the edema maybe under control before starting laser a bit later. So I usually do, you know, a round of three injections at first to see how they're responding, just make sure nothing is sort of proliferating, you know, worse, which I'd be surprised if it was, if they were on treatment, and then gradually talk to them about, you know, doing laser, in addition to getting maybe an FA, not maybe at the first visit, but at a subsequent visit to kind of assess how ischemic they really look. I know there's kind of this issue of, you know, if they're going to be compliant and coming back or not. So I do take that into consideration. But for most cases, I do start with injections.
You know, Farina, one of the things that came out recently, we've talked about a couple times on the podcast, but I'd be curious what you guys took from it, was the 5-year Protocol S results released at ASRS and then published in JAMA right around the same time by Gross et al., which kind of discussed that, again, approach of laser versus injections for PDR. The results, you know, show that, A, there was a little bit of a dropout rate, and some patients, you know, did not follow up. Mm-hmm. And also showed that, you know, some of the visual field advantages that were present in the injection group weren't quite as striking as they were initially. How does Protocol S factor into your decision making? And I think this is a hard question, because I'm sure it depends on what patient population you're dealing with and the individual patient, but does it affect your decision to use anti-VEGF or PRP primarily, or how you decide when to use them in combination?
Yeah, I mean, it's a good question, and it's such an interesting area in that we have sort of more options to think about how we're going to manage our patients with PDR. I mean, I do think that macular edema is a helpful component to guide you towards at least starting with anti-VEGF, just like Ali has mentioned, and then considering laser at a later time point. The other thing that's really helpful is that even if you are going to do laser to mitigate any sort of inflammatory component from the laser, you can also do in combination with the anti-VEGF treatment. I think the one thing that was mentioned to consider long-term injection treatment as your sort of primary approach for a specific patient that makes sense for you to do that you feel as though they're going to follow up, be regular with their visits, and tolerate the injections. Well, there is this question of what the endpoint might be. And I think even still with having the long-term data that you're describing, it's hard to know kind of what the endpoint of your injections might be. So I have particularly there, you know, we've had some patients when I was at Wills who were younger, who, you know, were doing sort of, one patient in particular, he skied, he did a lot of outdoor activities. He was very interested in sort of preservation of the peripheral, all peripheral vision that's possible. And so we did injections for him every month for a long period of time. And then he eventually sort of got tired of that. And we evaluated with FAA. He still had significant peripheral non-perfusion over a time period without treatment. He developed neovascularization again, and so we went ahead and did laser. So I think it's a little hard to know long-term what might make the most sense, but I think in the short term, you can temporize with the injections. It's just kind of hard to know what your endpoint might be, and I think that's really the kind of the critical question.
Yeah, and I think
choosing injection versus laser.
Right. And I think the thing Eichenbaum and White kind of touched on, which we're all trying to do, is we all have this trial data about a certain subset of patients in a certain trial with certain criteria, and it's kind of in this bubble, and you have multiple different bubbles with trials and with different outcomes. They're all designed differently. Some have sham, and going back into the AMD trial, some have sham control, some have, you know, had, you know, now anti-VEGF is your control. And in DME, for example, it'd be just different categories of patients. And then we see real patients, and we have to kind of connect the dots and kind of try to extrapolate what we can from each trial and apply it to each individual patient, kind of crossing it over. So, Ali, last thing before we move on to the next article, you know, ladder study was another thing, released phase 2 results at ASRS. Obviously, you can't take all the Protocol S data with you for ladder, but ladder, talking about a long-term anti-VEGF depot, let's say you could develop an anti-VEGF depot that lasts multiple years. how does Protocol S inform you about, you know, the value of that, or, you know, what other things we still need to monitor for, even if we do have long-term anti-VEGF on board?
Yeah, I guess it's tough because, you know, the real distinction is there center involving DME or not? So, you know, Protocol S is essentially, you know, ranibizumab versus PRP plus ranibizumab when there's DME for PDR. You know, a majority of the patients in the PRP group end up getting ranibizumab anyway. So, you know, latter kind of having a long-term, you know, depot or slow release of anti-VEGF, I think, you know, makes sense for a condition like AMD. But I think from RISE and RIDE, we know that, you know, the injection frequency drops off considerably, you know, year two and year three of treatment for say DME. So perhaps, you know, maybe not as necessary to have anti-VEGF on board for as long in a condition like DME versus say AMD. And, you know, the disease modifying aspect of anti-VEGF sort of over time, I think, is important, but necessarily having it for so long maybe not as critical for diabetes as for AMD. And I think the PRP aspect comes in too, because, you know, what I talked to some people about Protocol S is that it doesn't necessarily change my approach like too much, but you know, it just makes me not do as heavy or as dense of PRP as I may have done in the past for some of these PR patients, and instead maybe, you know, start off with the injection, see how things look, and then maybe a less dense PRP over time. So I think longer acting anti-VEGF makes sense for a lot of reasons, but sort of an implanted device, say like ladder for DME, I don't know if I'm quite there yet.
You know, switching gears a little bit, Dave Ree, who was a former Wills fellow from years ago, now is Long Island Retina. He wrote this article for Retinal Physician entitled "Subthreshold Laser Treatment of Retinal Disease: A Potential Alternative for Treating Center-Involving Macular Edema." Ali, you wanted to tell us a little bit about what he's talking about with subthreshold laser, and then, you know, we can talk a little bit as a group. You know, is this something that we should think about incorporating as an option? Do you think that this will be useful in the future? Or is pharmacology kind of bypass the laser era, as some people think?
Gotcha. So subthreshold, or, you know, quote unquote, micropulse type of laser is sort of a low energy laser approach for, you know, treating, you know, diabetic macular edema or focal edema, similar to traditional focal laser, but without kind of the drawbacks of the, you know, scarring and, you know, sort of permanent nature of the thermal damage with traditional laser. So, you know, when I read this article, I realized that, you know, I actually don't know much about subthreshold laser. So I don't think there's, you know, a ton of great studies out there that are informing us one way or another, whether it's for, you know, CSR or for DME, or in some people even said for AMD. But I think if there was, you know, clinical trial data that proved subthreshold laser would work or reduce injection burden, say for anti-VEGF treatments, I think, yeah, I would use it, but I don't know if we have that information yet. So for me, I'm kind of in a wait and see type mode, simply because I don't have a ton of experience with it, but two, I don't know of a ton of data that proves its efficacy just yet.
Yeah, so we used it at Wills. In particular, Alan Hall liked to use it for some of his patients. But I think, as Dave re-mentioned in his article, that the catch of it is that oftentimes it's used in settings in which patients are refractory to other treatments, namely, you know, having undergone injections of all three types of anti-VEGF, having had steroid injections, and then micropulse then being used as an attempt to see if any further improvement can, you know, happen structurally in terms of the macular edema. So it becomes really hard to isolate its effect. I think he did mention here, though, that there is a prospective trial underway that might isolate its role a bit more. But I think as it stands now, it serves well as like an adjunctive treatment, you know, in the way that it is being used as a, you know, when other treatments are not working quite as well, can we use it in addition to see what sort of effect we might get. But it's hard to argue against something as, you know, a very robust treatment for DME with something like a subthreshold laser.
Well, switching gears towards the surgical side, this is an article I was involved in as the senior author. It was Mike Vanacasa who works with the podcast. Shameless plug, and Nandini did a great job writing this article. Surgical management of proliferative diabetic retinopathy, considerations and treatment approaches. Again, just to summarize, I mean, we're not going to go through all this, but this is essentially this. They did a great job reviewing, like, you know, why people get PDR, what are your medical treatment options, when do you think about surgery, and then, you know, the data available about what types of surgery you do, how do you approach membranes, what sort of complications are there, what are the outcomes, how do you follow these patients, et cetera. So let's talk about diabetic surgery, and Ali, I'll let you start. When do you think about taking diabetics to surgery? And let me give you the background. Dan Chow came on the podcast, and he was advocating that maybe we should be taking patients to surgery earlier because the posterior hyoid is involved in the pathogenesis of the disease. And my caveat and caution I'll start with saying is that, you know, maybe taking some of these patients to surgery may be good on paper, but may not be good in real life. What are your thoughts on this kind of issue?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, Maria Barakal has kind of been the one who's really, I think, you know, promoted this idea of doing early vitrectomy for some of these diabetics who kind of, in no other good words, but the writing's sort of on the wall that these patients are going to proliferate, progress to a TRD, and maybe catching them and doing vitrectomy earlier so that there's not a scaffold for membranes to form may ultimately give them the best visual outcome. And I think, you know, she's probably right, you know, in certain populations, if they're not coming back for treatments or they're potentially non-compliant or their disease is just sort of raging out of control despite regular treatment, I think if you can get to somebody before they develop a TRD, that would be ideal. I do think we need probably more, you know, prospective surgical data about that, but there are some patients where you start to see those fronds of NV forming over the arcades. And I think, you know, intervening early is a good idea, but still for me is sort of on a case by case basis, not sort of a general rule for me. But I think, you know, TRD formation is obviously an easy choice for doing surgery if you think visual potential is good. And then non-clearing vitreous hemorrhage are the two most common reasons I go in for a diabetic.
You know, Farina, those were great points raised by Ali. You know, we were all mentored and taught at some point by Dr. Joe McGuire at Mid-Atlantic Retina and Wills. And I remember one of the things he used to talk about, though, was because diabetes is a systemic disease, that patients who kind of arrive at the point where they need surgery, they're very sick patients, and their disease has been uncontrolled for whatever reason. I mean, so he used to talk about how you have to be careful taking these patients immediately to surgery because there's almost the idea that you may give them instant gratification, which maybe they won't get with surgery, depending on how bad their disease is. They may have macular ischemia. They may have traction involving the fovea. And the idea that, you know, there are no quick fixes for this disease process if their systemic disease is not controlled. So how do you factor in the systemic factor and kind of the psychology of it? Because patients view surgery, I think, sometimes different than surgeons view surgery. And how a patient looks back on their surgery and the surgery can be very different. You know, from an outcomes perspective, we might see the outcome is good, and it may be good in terms of preventing complication and stabilizing these processes, but they may view their vision maybe not being at the level they preferred or desired and may assign blame to the surgeon, for example.
Yeah, I mean, those are good points, and I think Dr. McGuire similarly is really great at counseling the patients on expectations. And I mean, I think, you know, one thing that some of the Wells attendings will tell the patients is that, you know, their, you know, what's happening in their eye is a marker of what's happening in the rest of their body, but also that, you know, in terms of the disease progression, it's a runaway train. And we're just looking to at least get it back on track or slow things down, but we can never quite get things back to where they were. And I think expectation management is key. I think more than maybe any other surgery, it's under promising over delivering. Really just, we don't know if the vision will be better at all, but we just want to prevent things from getting worse. So I think that is true. That being said, you know, it's always a risk-benefit. Some of these patients are very young, and while they may have, you know, very advanced disease, we don't know how things are going to go. You know, they have functional, you know, work and it's things like that. So sometimes it's worth that risk, you know, hoping that you'll have at least an improved outcome. So, you know, I agree with Dr. McGuire, of course, you know, but sometimes it may be worth the risk to get them to a more functional and independent state sometimes.
Yeah, I think, Declan McGuire would also say, you do want the eye to not be so active or hot at the time of your surgery as well. I think kind of speaking to your earlier point, Jay, to maybe have them get their, if their A1C is out of control, 15 plus, they may not be, fit for surgery period, just from a, cardiovascular standpoint. So I do think you should wait till their systemic disease is addressed if it is truly out of control. If it's not, getting in some PRP or getting in, obviously preoperative anti-VEGF was always something that was taught to us as well. On my scoop, they used to always talk about, getting in PRP and some of these chronic appearing TRDs or TRDs you worry about bleeding quite a bit, just so that along with preoperative anti-VEGF, you can maybe avoid some of that. But the expectation management part, I think, is likely the biggest point. And if you can somehow get an OCTA or an IVFA, there's not vitreous hemorrhage in the way to assess if their macula is ischemic, I think that's very helpful to do. But, often the image quality is not good enough. But if you can, that would be a good idea in my book.
Yeah, I those are all really, really good points. And I think that before we talk about surgery specifics, what you guys prefer to do, I think it's appropriate that we're spending most of the time talking about the decision to operate, because that's often the most difficult part of it. I think they're like you said, Ali, it's very patient by patient, but there's various scenarios, right? There's a scenario that Dan was talking about, or we were talking about early, like they have VH, they have neovascular Franz, but there's really not a TRD yet. There's not really traction. And then there's the chronic kind of TRD that's macula involving, the visual prognosis isn't great, you're trying to stabilize things. I think laser... Maria Barrichello has said that she doesn't love laser in the former category, especially if you're going in. I think in the latter, it can be very helpful for multiple reasons besides reducing the ischemic drive. I think from a planes perspective, having the laser visible and it can really help you from a planes perspective when you're dissecting, although with our new ways of kind of seeing the retina and better lighting, it may not be as critical as it was in the past. My thing, when we talk about specifics in surgery, my question for you guys is, how often are you guys opening a additional instrument beyond your cutter or an additional lighting source beyond your light pipe? Ali, I'll let you go first.
For like a VH, probably, nothing other than the endo laser, if it's truly just a, vitreous hemorrhage, to add PRP potentially at the end of the case. But for TRDs, I usually, depending on how bad they looked preoperatively, have some things sort of on board. Usually a lighted pick is a tool I like to avoid having to use a chandelier for bimandibular technique if you can get away with it alone. I think an individual 27 gauge cutter is excellent for dissecting and kind of segmenting some of these plaques that can cost the same amount as a disposable scissor if you talk to your local representative from whichever machine you're using. And then if it's really bad, then obviously a chandelier, and then going in with bimanual techniques, likely with forceps and curved horizontal scissors are usually my go-to scenario. So it just depends on how bad the TRD is when I get in there.
Farina, what are your thoughts on cataract surgery, either preoperatively or at the time of surgery, in a phakic patient with, let's say, a diabetic TRD or VH?
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, I think that... if there's pretty significant posterior subcapsular cataract, then it's often helpful to, do it at the time of surgery. As, we've mentioned before, a lot of these patients are very sick and, it can be hard to get them if they are for a lot of different reasons. So the combined approach would be helpful. And so doing the optic would start. I think in the absence of significant, visually obscuring I think significant PSC, often you're able to do the TRD repair successfully without having to remove the cataract. And a lot of times they're young, and so I think that sometimes the correction of cataract is not so quick. And so it's helpful to do, and the fact that you have the opportunity to take the patient to the OR at one time, so it may be worth it doing together.
Yeah, I'll say as an attending, I've started doing this more often. If they have a significant cataract, I'll do a phaco and put a lens at the time of surgery. I think the one thing I've learned from doing this or talking to people to do this is that patients who get a phaco vitrectomy have a different degree of inflammation than patients who simply just have a vitrectomy. And so I'm a little more aggressive with steroids. And topically, I also have a low threshold to give them a subtenon Kenalog, which carries its own risk, for example, of intraocular pressure rise. But I do think the one thing I learned is that they can get very significant inflammation, especially if they haven't had PRP before. Even if you're not doing a phaco, doing a full PRP in someone, you know, out to the oral serrata can cause inflammation. But you have to throw in a phaco, it might be a 15-minute quick phaco, but it's still, there's a degree of inflammation and kind of spillover into the eye, and that happens with that. The other thing is, you know, what I tell the residents or fellows or people I'm working with is, like, you don't want to mess up your view further if you're planning to combo at the same time. So it's kind of, I do think that your cornea will start to cloud, even with a very nice phaco. It kind of reduces how much time you'd have. So I would consider doing, like, if you're going to do them at the same time, you know, just make sure that you do a pretty efficient job of it, because, and know that you can do the TRD with a little less time than maybe you anticipated, because you will lose your view faster. I don't know if you've had the same experience, Ellie.
Yeah, I mean, I agree kind of with what you said. I do think there is definitely more inflammation. The cornea will go a little quicker, especially if, you know, the phaco didn't go perhaps as planned, I guess you can say. I do think they also have a little bit more risk of hypotony and bleeding post-op, and kind of anecdotally the cases I've seen. But I kind of do the same. If it is visually significant, meaning I don't think I'll do a good enough job with the posterior segment portion, I will take the cataract out. If not, I usually leave it in, especially if they're going to get oil. I leave it in, knowing that, you know, when we do the oil out procedure in the future, hopefully then we can address the cataract at that time. So, you know, everybody's OR setup is different too. Some places it's a lot easier to do a combination surgery than it is to do without. So depending on your OR setting, I think that factors in also.
Switching to a different paper, new insight into obstructive sleep apnea and diabetic retinopathy, treating OSA may stop reverse retinal disease progression, by Amy Chang and Albert Wu. Farina, just want to summarize what they kind of talked about, and then what did you take from this and incorporate into your practice? I mean, I think OSA is something we don't really think or talk a lot about as ophthalmologists, but maybe we should be.
I think it was a nice review of actually several papers that have been written on an association between OSA and diabetes, but the sort of different stages and being able to break it down a little bit. There hasn't been like an overwhelming clear sort of their relationship or something like that, but a lot of the papers are supportive that there is a relationship. So what I take away from it is that, you know, if you have any sort of modifiable risk factors, it's worth knowing about and worth addressing. So I think it's something that I will definitely ask about with the patient, in particular if their body habitus is suggestive or anything is suggestive. Knowing about it can help with their outcome. It's a huge win if you're able to identify it.
Ali, your thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, I thought, I guess it sort of makes sense that, you know, somebody with sleep apnea might have maybe worse outcomes with, you know, hypertension and diabetic related complications, but definitely isn't something I routinely ask about. So maybe, you know, that's probably what the article did for me, is maybe I should be asking some of these patients, particularly the ones that maybe aren't responding as well to anti-VEGF as I expected them to, perhaps for DME, to see if they know if they have sleep apnea, particularly if they have concurrent hypertension. And if they have no idea, maybe ask them to talk to their primary care doctor about that. So, you know, it doesn't necessarily change what I would do per se. I would still treat them as I think they need it based on their vision and OCT, et cetera. But if it is a modifiable risk factor that can help calm the DME down, which is suggested by some of those articles, then that's, you know, good for everybody, I guess you could say.
Yeah, and the last thing, the article, we're going to go into that, but it's the same thing about thinking about thing or asking about something, is what's titled Advances in Low Vision Research. It was written by a contributing writer, Susan Worley. It just goes through some of the technologies that are coming out for low vision. But I think low vision is something that we should be thinking about or talking about all the time. And I've tried to make it part of my reflex when I see someone whose vision is not very good or they're legally blind to bring this up or refer them to here, our referral. We have low vision services both here and outside at the Miami Lighthouse for the Blind. But I do think this is something that we forget about when we're talking about trials and injections, or okay, you know, we're injecting and maintaining your one eye with wet AMD when, you know, it's better seeing at 2100. We can't forget about this. We're so busy. And so I do think that it is something that we need to kind of always remember, because there are way, I mean, functionally, the patient doesn't care if they're 2100, 2400, just can they do what they want to do? And I don't know if you guys have encountered similar things where, I'll be very honest, I feel like there have been times where I just have missed the boat for a visit or two, and then I think about it later and like, oh, you know what, we actually should do this and get them connected.
Yeah, I was just going to say, I think, you know, as retina specialists, ophthalmologists, I think we're very good at sort of treating disease, but not necessarily of helping patients live their life with their disease, I guess you could say. So, you know, patients with bilateral geographic atrophy, you might say, hey, you know, we have this new Apellis trial coming out that you might be, you know, a candidate for, but, you know, they still have to do what they need to do every day of the week. So I gave a recent talk at like the Los Angeles Braille Institute, which has, you know, this wide array of low vision resources. And I was kind of honestly a little embarrassed that I didn't really know much about any of these new tools coming out. And I think that that article did a great job of sort of introducing some of the new technology-based tools that are going to become available. But I do not feel like I have a good vocabulary or am well-versed on these different tools. And also the article brought up the issue of reimbursement. You know, can patients even get these tools if they are helpful? I think that's another major thing that should be addressed and supported by, I guess, the physician or ophthalmologist side of things.
Farina, your thoughts?
Yeah, I think it's one of those things that, like you were saying, is often forgotten. And I think a couple of things. I think it's probably worthwhile like a visit to whatever low vision resources in the region to kind of know what they have. Also, in some way, incorporating it into your workflow for your visits. And I think if it becomes more standard, it's certainly useful. We know we underutilize it. But if it's incorporated into the workflow in a more way, I think patients ultimately get more out of them. I think it's just so easy because we're used to, you know, sort of our hammers that we already have, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
True.
I don't know, have you guys ever seen a note written by a low vision specialist?
I have a couple patients where they're very good at sending notes.
Yeah.
I have no idea what they're talking about.
I have zero idea about half the things they're talking about, like luminance, this test, that test, reading speed. I literally have no idea what they're talking about. It's kind of like, I don't know, when you're in med school.
I'm glad you're honest about that, because I don't know it either. And it's probably how everyone else feels when we send them our notes about their patients with diabetes.
No, absolutely.
It's a reminder.
If you're a med student who hasn't done ophthalmology and you read an ophthalmology note, you're like, I don't know what any of these acronyms, I don't know what any of this stuff means. It's like watching a game where you don't know the rules. And I think low vision is becoming more like that, given the advances in, you know, the tech that's actually coming out for it, that, you know, we're even going to get further behind. So, you know, from my point of view, if this was maybe incorporated in some of our meetings kind of in an efficient way, saying, hey, these are some new tools out here that you guys should know about, I would welcome that kind of education per se at our national meetings or otherwise. It doesn't have to, you know, take forever or be sort of overly comprehensive, but just to give us the basics would be a good idea. So I think this article was great in sort of introducing that. So if there were more articles about a little bit more in details about what's really coming out or what's currently available, that'd be welcome for me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I would say that's an excellent idea. And I know what it's like to watch a sport where you don't understand the rules, because I tried to watch Tiger win the PGA Championship because I thought it was cool, and I had no idea what was going on.
Yeah. I thought you were gonna say cricket, Jay.
No, I was gonna say that, but with this company, I felt like that would just label me as too much of a, I don't know, to use the term, ABCD. So I'm just gonna stay away from anything. I completely understand cricket.
Yeah, we got
totally.
You, though, Jay.
Wickets and runs and I think that's, and bats. They have bats. That's true. Okay, well, and a bowler, don't forget the bowler. Farina, Ali, thank you for joining me. Thanks for doing this. Hopefully we'll catch up soon. And again, for the listeners, if you want to read the articles we were used as kind of jumping off points, they're all up on retinalphysician.com. Thank you, guys.
Thanks. Have a good one.
As always, you can find this episode and all prior episodes on our website, retinapodcast.com. That's RETINAPodcast.com. All 125 episodes, including this one, can be found there sorted by category. You'll find our blog, Equal Round Reactive Lessons from Our Pupils. On the website, you can sign up for our mailing list to get updates on the most recent episodes. And at the bottom are links to subscribe in the iTunes Store as well as Google Play. You can like us on our Facebook page or find us in the podcast section of the iTunes Store and Google Play. We're on Twitter at Retina Podcast, and to contact us, click on the Contact Us link on our website or email us at retinapodcast@gmail.com. We really love getting feedback, both on things we can do better and things we are already doing well. Really, really appreciate anyone who subscribes via iTunes or Google Play to leave your positive comments in the form of a review. Many thanks to Drs. Farina Ali and Ali Khan for joining me. Thanks to Dr. Louis Kai, Mike Benincasa, and Angela Chang for producing a great episode. Listeners, thank you for what you do on a daily basis, the patient care you provide, the articles you read and publish, and the conversations you inspire. This is Jay Schreeder, signing off.
Feeling.
This is straight from the cutter's mouth.